Hello, everybody, and welcome to This Game Where with me, Ashley.
And me, Chris. Hello, everyone. Hope you're okay. Hope you're okay, Ashley.
I'm okay.
Other
Thank
than
you very much.
The
How are
terrible
you?
Terrible heat. I'm okay other than the terrible heat.
Yeah, it's a bit warm.
It's very warm.
So warm. Horrifically warm. And I think it's going to get warmer. So, yay. Way to play into this British stereotype of talking about the weather right away.
I know, right?
Both of us moaning about how warm it is.
Well, at least you managed to make it quite flippant. Then I was going to sort of do a bit about global warming and climate change and that. So yours is a bit more glib.
Leaning into the stereotypes. That's what we
are they stereotypes?
Should do. What, of the British talking about the weather?
Yeah. Yeah, they are, aren't they?
Yeah, they are definitely stereotypes.
Oh, if only I had my cup of tea next to me. Sadly, I don't. I've got a glass of water.
You know what? Cup of tea would be good. It would cool me down.
It really, does that work? My dad was obsessed with that when I was growing up, drinks.
It doesn't work.
It was a really thing.
Well, actually, it might work. So, yeah. Personally, for me, I don't feel like it works. But there's something to do with the way that it affects your internal temperature. And then that affects how you sweat or something. I can't remember.
Yeah.
That's the justification for it. Or whatever that was, but I don't remember it well enough to be able to repeat it for you, so apologies.
That sounded like the kind of pop science my dad used to justify it with, but yeah. He also
I really don't know.
When it was hot, he also used to get us to run our wrists under cold
taps.
That
does work.
Does that work?
That does work, yeah, that's right. Smart. Because the blood vessels, that's one of the closest places they are to the skin. And if you put your hands into a cold bath of water or cold, if you put your hands into a cold anything of water or just anything cold up to the wrists, the blood is passing directly basically against the cold water, so it can exchange heat with the cold water.
Nice.
And it pulls heat out of your blood, your circulatory system.
That makes sense.
Yeah,
right,
so that one definitely works.
We've done the weather. We've done some pop science. What's the game today?
Some science. That's not pop science. That's just science.
Genuine science.
That's real science. Today, I think you're going to be happy.
Oh.
Because it is this game where you are a lone knight mustering up allies to take on a major threat.
Zelda? Dungeon Keeper?
Which one are you going for?
Dungeon Keeper.
No.
Ah! Zelda.
I mean, there's so many Zelda games. What are you punting for?
Zelda 2?
No.
Zelda 3? Is there a Zelda 3? I could keep going. I don't know which Zelda.
You're going to be going for a long time because it's Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom.
We're going to do this one, are we?
We're going to do this one, yeah.
Whoa.
I've got so many spoilers lined up for you.
Is this
not really?
Is this why
we're gonna?
When I was just talking about it, you said,
"Yeah, it is." Yeah, because we were having a chat about it before we came on to the recording, and I thought this needs to be sort of the conversation that we have this evening. We're doing Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. It came out. I can't remember the exact date, but it came out very recently,
12th of May.
Brilliant, thank you. So, 12th of May this year, and it is just coming up to the end of June. I would have done it sooner, but I think that you have had a bit of a struggle getting on the game for yourself, haven't you?
Yeah, because I'm in a rough moment back, because I managed to get my daughter into games, as long-time listeners will know. We did Animal Crossing episodes during lockdown, and I've talked about games that she enjoys. And when she was about 3 or 4, when I was playing through Breath of the Wild, she absolutely adored sitting and watching me play it. We've now got Tears of the Kingdom, and she absolutely adores playing it, so much so that she will just sit and play it, and I don't really get much of a look in. She actually said to me yesterday she was getting a bit cross with me because I sort of pulled ahead of her slightly yesterday, and she said, "Oh, can you just stop playing it for a bit so that I can get ahead of you again?" And I said,
"Why?
No, because I'm a real good dad."
No, that is being a real good dad. Why did she want you to do that? I don't understand.
I think she liked the FOMO that I was experiencing, and she liked being able to lord it over me, the fact that she knew stuff that I didn't.
Right, okay. So when any Zelda game comes out, and any game really that I'm particularly invested in, I do like to keep myself out of knowing too much about it. Zelda more than any other, and me and Hannah, we play these games simultaneously in parallel, but I'll tend to avert my gaze or do a different thing or go to a different room while Hannah's playing it. And,
right.
And then I'll play it while Hannah's not around. And yeah, that's paid off dividends this time around and previously. But there is a point that I'll get to, and it'll be some hours in, but there'll be a point where actually I feel like I know the game well enough now that I don't mind necessarily experiencing things vicariously. Mm-hmm. So today, as an example, I've watched Hannah complete some stuff that I am on the cusp of doing. I've seen Hannah do it, but being able to experience it while Hannah plays it is actually the way that I used to play, or not play, but the way I used to experience Zelda games anyway. The first Zelda game I played, in fact, the first two Zelda games I played were Link to the Past and Ocarina of Time. And I use played in a loose sense because actually I was the, what is it? The man in the chair? I can't remember. The man in the chair for my friend. So he would be playing the game. He would have the controller. I would be watching. I would be giving advice if needed and also looking up any, because he had the walkthroughs, and if we had any problems, I would look up the relevant page and pass on the information.
Oh, I refer to that as being the Hyacinth Bucket.
The Hyacinth Bucket.
Yeah, because you know when she was when
that's
when she used to tell
such
Richard.
A great reference.
Oh, don't slag off Keith appearances.
Go on. Tell us all about Hyacinth Bucket from when she was, keeping up appearances
when Richard
on
was
a
driving,
games podcast.
When Richard was driving, she'd sit there in the front seat
Richard.
And tell him what he was doing wrong and all that. The backseat driver.
I don't even think that's on television anymore.
It's
I don't even think it's on UK Gold.
Oh, it's probably on
anymore.
Something like that. ITV3.
Oh, no, I don't think it is. But, you know, who the heck that's listening to this is going to be like, oh, yeah, Hyacinth Bucket. I know who that is.
Well,
the man in the chair, I think, comes from some. I think it comes from Batman or something like that. Like, it's the idea of having the Oracle. I think it is in Batman. Which irony, I guess, is Mr. Brown. What's it? Gordon's. It's Gordon's daughter, the Oracle.
Oh, Barbara.
And she is Barbara. That's the one. So she has an accident and ends up being his person who does all the computery stuff and passes on information through an earpiece or whatever. So you know, at least I don't necessarily wholly understand the reference, but at least my reference was vaguely in the realms of the audience that we might be hitting.
Wow.
Keeping up appearances from the late 80s early 90s.
Great show.
Not so much.
Great show. So much. I will die on that cross.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Well, before we move off to different playstyles, then the playstyle that we're doing is that my daughter will be playing it, and I'll watch her. I won't avert my gaze or anything. I will help. I will chip in if needed. But she is pretty much independent now, and it's got to the point now where there's some things where I'll play it through on hers, or I'll watch her play it, and then I'll do it on mine and be able to. I know what to do now. But if I get to that, I will go off and do something else if possible within the game, because I want to kind of leave a bit of a gap between. But then equally, there's one example. So she's doing the Gerudo Temple at the moment. The temple
of... Well, that's what Hannah's just done.
Ah, okay.
Lightning.
And she found it quite difficult.
I mean, that is a spoiler, so we should probably make sure that we, you know, going forwards, there may be some spoilers.
There will be spoilers.
I don't know how heavy... It'll depend on how you feel, I guess, as to how heavy these are. I would consider... the notion of there being a lightning temple spoiler.
Fair. Okay, but she started on her save and she found it quite tricky, and so I started doing it a bit, and then she decided, oh, actually I want to go to do something else. So when I encounter that on my save, I will kind of know that I have to do the first few bits of it, but no more. But what I'm doing is I'm now doing something different in the game to stave off that moment, just to kind of put a bit of a bridge of time between the two.
I do the same thing as well. Like, Hannah has done the Lightning Temple today, and I've seen her do that. I am actually at the doors of the Lightning Temple and on my save, so I probably will turn around and hotfoot it somewhere else and do something else, just so that when I come to it myself, it's not completely fresh in my mind.
Outside the Lightning Temple, you encountered the Gibdo... the big...
Mm.
How did it attack you? Because on my daughter's save... it attacked her. Well, this was the point. This massive hulking creature appeared, and she passed the control to me and said, nope. which made me laugh. So,
yeah.
But I attacked it twice using the lightning attack and 2 arrows, and then it then fled up to the top of the temple. And I mentioned this to another friend who's also playing through the game.
You mentioned it to me last week and we had this conversation. So yeah, I know what you're going to say.
Yeah,
carry on.
Okay, well, a third party, not you then. And he said that he had this massive battle with it outside the doors the 10th of time. And that's not what happened on my save or my daughter's save at all, which is interesting.
Yeah, so there's a reason for that, I think. I had a more similar experience to your friend. And I, because you told me that you hit it once. Today you said twice, but you hit it a minor amount of times and it fled.
Potato. And
yeah, it's obviously there's a scripted moment when it's lost so much health, a certain amount of health, it will flee. And that is what happened across all three, mine, yours and your friend's situations. But the difference will be, when did you go to that lightning temple? What were you equipped with in terms of weapons and other powers? And your friend maybe had lesser weapons and therefore had to have much more of an engagement with it, whereas you might have had much more powerful weapons or dealt with it in a different way.
It's just a bow and arrow. It wasn't anything particularly, but probably would have been quite a strong bow, I guess.
Yeah. And did you pop? Well, this is one of the things that I'm really enjoying about the game, to be honest, that it's so it, people had some problems with Breath of the Wild and the way that it scaled its enemies and its weapons and things. And, I feel like I didn't have those problems personally, but I feel like this might have refined those two systems in such a way that actually it's enhanced the game. And one of the reasons is that people are having different experiences depending on how they go through the journey they take through the game, and also how they augment their power with different monster parts. You know, like if people are inclined to avoid monsters, they might not have such powerful weapons, which means that when they come into the bigger battles, they're gonna struggle maybe a little bit more. But there's a balance there, really, because they're avoiding the struggle of fighting the Black Bokoblins, and then they're having a bigger struggle with the bigger bosses like the Queen Ghibdo,
The Black Horoblins.
Oh, Horoblins are, as the name suggests, pretty horrible. I spent some time running away from those as well. The Queen Ghibdo is one of the things that I wanted to talk about, to be honest, because one of the other things that I'm really enjoying about this game is the different ways that it upends the traditions of Zelda. And that is a good example. I can't think that this has happened. It possibly has, but this is an example of fighting the boss at the beginning of a temple or a dungeon or whatever. So the notion of when I fired my arrow at that big purple spot on the front of the lightning temple, I was just anticipating the door opening and behind it, and then this big old creature lollops out and goes on a rampage. Yeah, I mean, it's not the full fight, but I just really enjoyed the shock of it, really. There have been some other parts. Have you come across anything like that in your play?
Just quickly before I answer that question, just with the weapons, it's crossed my mind that, because there's another friend who also does the podcast who really...
You don't have two more friends.
I've got a few more than two. I've got a whole three more friends. And he really bounced off Breath of the Wild because he didn't like the weapons breaking. And I think this goes back to Undertale, we talked about last week, that Undertale takes what you think an RPG is and it upends it. And I think and we talked about how RPGs train you to do to act in certain ways and to react to certain situations in certain ways. I think RPGs, you're taught to, right, you've got a really good weapon, you've got to hold on to it, this is your weapon used for everything. And then because they break, then you can't do that. And I like in this one that it says that it's because of the gloom's infected the air, and that's what's causing the weapons to break. And that's quite a cool way to tie into the lore of the game. So I just as an aside, I personally it did take me, when I read Breath of the Wild, it did take me a while to kind of get into that, the fact that I couldn't stockpile weapons. But once you kind of get out of that, it's fine, because the weapons are fairly common.
Hannah's about 100 hours into the proceedings at this point, I think. And she absolutely has started hoarding or saving certain weapons.
Oh, rock hammers. I always hoard rock hammers. Although it's not pretty rock hammers, easy to use them.
It's anything that seems a little bit out of the ordinary. So I think she got a Biggeron sword at one point, and she's still got that, and it's been about 40 hours since she got it. And then today she got a particularly special sword, and I'm imagining that she will finish the game with that one.
Right.
I had a similar feeling in The Legend of Zelda. I had a similar feeling in Breath of the Wild, where I would try and avoid using weapons that I thought I might need in a future larger battle.
Yeah.
And it lasted quite a long time, but at some point I just went, oh, hang on, I keep coming across these, you know, giant fire swords, and actually maybe they do want me to just use them and cycle through them. So I managed to break the cycle for myself in Breath of the Wild, and I've never really got into that rut with this game, and I think it's because they just seem so readily available. The fact that you are coming across lots of, say, soldiers' swords, I can't remember the name of them, Traveller's Claymores.
Traveller's Claymores.
So you're coming across Traveller's Claymores left, right and centre, and they're properly buggered, like they're all degraded and broken from the gloom, but as soon as you pop a Bokoblin horn on, you've got a pretty damn decent sword that's so going to last a good amount of time. I'm really enjoying seeing the way that different monster parts affect different weapons. I'd never used boomerangs in the first game, but actually boomerangs are kind of becoming one of my favourite weapons in this game. Because
I've
only
counted boomerangs yet.
Oh, right, okay. Lizalfos tend to carry boomerangs, right. So maybe take on a few Lizalfos. I also like that instead of having your elemental weapons limited to, you know, rods and specific types of sword, you can augment your weapons in whatever way you like. Mm. So that sword that you like using, that you're coming across quite often, that can be your fire sword. And
ruby on the ends, and then the Rito area is your lobster, oyster. World's your oyster. That's it. That's the phrase. Not lobster.
Well, yeah, that's a nice little nice little trick with a ruby on.
I broke them. Well, one thing.
If you like it, put a ruby on it or whatever. Yeah.
One thing that happens that was quite frustrating, but also quite funny at the same time. You mentioned the weapons having different skills attached to them. I did actually from the Rito area. I got a sword that, because it was from the Rito area, when you attack with it, it fires out a gust of wind at the same time.
Yes.
Around the Rito area, I found a shrine with a crystal in, which, just to loop back, because we went off about 5 minutes ago, you said times in which the game's done stuff that I'm pleasantly surprised by. I like the shrines where you have to find the crystal to activate the shrine, where you have to find the crystal somewhere else, and it's connected by this beam of light, so you're given a bit of a helping hand, but then you have to activate the shrine. I like that the puzzle is actually finding how to get the crystal to the shrine itself. And then when you get in the shrine, it's just a case of going and get the treasure, get the light of blessing, job done. I like that that's the, you know, Breath of the Wild, there's 120 shrines, each one of them is a puzzle box, there you go. This one, the puzzle box, then gets brought out into the world itself, into the overworld, which I think is cool. Anyway, so I was doing one of those, and the crystal was down in a nearby chasm that had a couple of light likes and a couple of bokoblin skeletons in, what they call stal... Blin or something like that. Anyway, doesn't matter.
Let's not worry.
And I killed the likes, I killed the skeleton, the goblins, and I had this crystal. And I was in this chasm, I couldn't figure out how to get to it. And over in the corner of this chasm, there's a couple of rockets. Okay, I'm going to use Ultra Hand, use Ultra Hand onto the rockets, onto the crystal, line it up under there. Brilliant, right, job done. Get my sword out to strike the rockets to launch up into the sky. Of course, I use the blade that's got the wind power, so not only to activate them, but I also knock them over, so the rockets then charging off into the wall of the chasm, which was quite annoying, but there you go.
But fun.
It was
like, I think that they've done a really good job. I mean, there's so much to talk about in this. I kind of think that this conversation is just going to be whatever we can get to and whatever comes up. Because you've just touched on the Ultra Hand mechanic, which is a pretty major part of this. It's basically the way that you engage with any of the puzzles. In Breath of the Wild, you had your five runes, and they were.
It was Magnesis was the one that let you interact with metal things, and Ultrahand is essentially Magnesis, but to everything. But it's so much more than that, because you can join things together. And then the shrines, what I really like about the shrines in this game is that I feel that it's much broader in how you can solve the shrines because of this Ultra Hand and the other abilities. And I feel when you solve a puzzle within a shrine, you get across maybe a chasm or something using something, and just the little victory music, those few notes. Mm. I feel so... Like I feel like the game is saying well done. I feel like I've earned that more than I did in Breath of the Wild.
Yeah, they've changed the way you engage with those powers. Those powers kind of all are encapsulated in that single thing, Ultra Hand, and they've done that by having all of these different objects that are Zonai objects. I can't remember again the term that they use in the game, but they've condensed all of what you had in Breath of the Wild down into Ultra Hand, and then taken this weapon system and changed it in such a way that they've made everything have some value. And I know that my pockets were absolutely stuffed with anything and everything that I could have possibly picked up during Breath of the Wild that I then never really used.
Yeah.
And
occasionally would sell them, but things like apples or bokoblin parts were worth so few rupees that there wasn't really much point inside
them. They just sat there,
didn't they?
I've never put an apple on the arrows, but I'm interested to maybe give it a go. And there's certainly the monster parts. The monster parts were to me completely useless, because I didn't really do elixirs in Breath of the Wild. Whereas here, they have so much utility, and it's making me think about fighting them in a different way as well. Because instead of them being an obstacle that I have to clear in order to get to the thing that I want to do, I'm kind of looking at different groupings of monsters and going, well, actually, there's a couple of lightning Lizalfos there. I could grab their horns. And they're now a resource that I'm
completely
having to harvest.
Every time I see a Keese or an Acra, what they're called, the flying bat.
Aracuda.
Every time I see them, I kill them, because the eyes and the wings are absolutely amazing. So the eyes let the arrow fly from further away, and then the wing is a homing device, which is absolutely invaluable. So
you've done that the other way around.
Botheration.
The eye is the homing device. The wing gets you a lot more distance.
Which makes a lot more sense, really. You're right.
It does, yeah. So they've given utility to pretty much everything that is in your inventory, and it might not be an amazing amount of inventory. We'll find it. It may not be an amazing amount of utility. I don't know, as I say, what happens when you put an apple on the end of
I don't either.
An arrow, but you know, I'm going to find out tomorrow when I give it a go.
Yeah.
There's, as I say, so much to talk about. Weapons in this game, great. The fact that they've changed things up and made your inventory have value, great. The environment. So there was a lot of humming and hawing about the fact that they were reusing the map. And you and I certainly have talked about this. I don't know whether we've talked a little bit about it on the podcast, but Hyrule is Hyrule in Tears of the Kingdom. Hyrule is the Hyrule of Breath of the Wild. However, it's got one very key difference. And this is without taking into account the other fairly large differences, but there's one key difference, and it is the addition of five or so years. The time that we've waited for this game, the 6 years, it's the same amount of time outside the game as has passed inside the game. So we've waited 6 years. It's been around about that, I think, in the game. What that means is that you've got out of this calamity, the literal calamity, wasn't it? It was Calamity Ganon. You've overcome this big awful thing, and you've got a world that is whose inhabitants have started to try and rebuild and put together a semblance of a society that spans across Hyrule. And places that you had been in Breath of the Wild, they still exist, and there are also then new places. We've touched on this with a different Zelda game, and it's Skyward Sword. One of the things that I really love about Skyward Sword is that it takes you to these areas, these spaces, and then halfway-ish through the game, it makes you go back to those spaces, and those spaces have changed mm-hmm. in some quite tangible way sometimes, and then in others the way that you traverse them or the way that you think about them has changed because of the objects that you've picked up. Well, here, just the passage of time is what's changed this world that you came to know so well over the 100 or so hours that you were in it 6 years ago. And I think that it is a pretty stellar achievement to have put together a game that makes you feel like you're going back to a place that you know. I've never quite had it the way that it's been delivered here.
It's
between Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom.
It's familiar but different, because you've also got the upheaval, the thing that's happened to cause the events of this game, has also affected the physical geography. So you've got where there might have been a sheer cliff before, you've now got these weird cube shaped bits sticking out of them, which you can then use as ascend, one of the other new abilities, which is an amazing ability, so you can go straight through them. But it just makes the geography itself, it feels similar but different. The only thing I can think of, I can liken it to, is during autumn 2020, me and my wife and daughter went to on a lockdown holiday to the city that I went to university in. And it was returning somewhere I'd not been for, at that point, over a decade. And it was the same as what you were just saying. It felt, oh, I know that place. Oh, that building used to be this, but it's still the same building. And it was this really weird disconnect of, like, it was the same, as I said, the same but different. And that's how I feel going into Hyrule now.
Yeah, I'm glad that you said that, because that's exactly the sense that I'm getting as well. I started working in the city that I went to university in. And it's been a decade or so since I had properly sort of inhabited that space. And a lot has changed in that time. And going back to it has been a mixture of nostalgia and fresh exploration, mm-hmm. fresh experience. And that's a really heady and strange thing to have. It's the same as, like, if you've been on holiday somewhere and you go back. Me and Hannah in 2019, I think, went to Barcelona. And I'd been there. That was the first time my family, when I was younger, went away on a holiday abroad. It was to that area, Calella de la Costa, it actually was. And Hannah and I going back and doing some of the things, seeing some of the sights that I'd seen when I was, I think, 9 years old, only sort of nearly 20 years, 25 years later. It's not like any other feeling that you get.
No.
Except with this.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've had it with other games. I've had it you know, when I think Zelda delivers for me, it delivers this in a way, but not in the same way as this time. But you know, like when you're sort of in the last few weeks heading up to a new Zelda game coming out, and you've been playing them since you were since I was about 8 or 9 years old. And every time a new one comes out, there's like this anticipation, and then you get into it and it's what you know, but it's a little bit different and a little bit changed. Well, that's a great feeling, and it's similar, but this is actually because it's the same places, the same people that you're going to see, and you're seeing that everything's moved on a little bit and that you've been out of it. You're like, you've left this place, and everybody's kind of moved on a little bit, and the spaces that you inhabited, they've changed because the people there have changed them. There isn't anything quite like it in gaming. I certainly can't think of them. Final Fantasy X did a similar-ish thing
with 10-2.
You had this, had this pretty epic story told, and this love story inside it, and then you thought it was over, and then suddenly, and I was quite surprised when they did it, this game, Final Fantasy X-2, comes out, and it's, you go to it, and it's the same, but it's different, and you've also got this melancholy that hangs over the whole thing, because the main character is missing, or one of the main characters is missing, and the world has moved on, and actually the world is quite a celebratory and upbeat world, and the people that you're controlling, the people that are the main characters now, the trio of women, they are celebrities, and they are all quite sort of, hey, woo, we're upbeat, happy people, you know, with this melancholy underneath. The other thing that I want to say about that before we move on, about this passage of time actually enhancing the game. Maybe there's two things. If they'd moved this game on in game terms, if they'd moved the world on 6 years, but they'd put this game out 2 years after the first one, I don't think you'd have the same feeling.
It wouldn't have felt earned.
I really don't. No, exactly. It wouldn't have felt earned. And I kind of feel like the fact that it's 6 years in, 6-ish years in game and actually 6 years in the real world, it kind of enhances this this sort of return feeling, this weirdness that I'm experiencing.
Well, you saying that is interesting. Just sort of a brief, I'll talk about my relationship with Zelda games, is that this is the first time I've played a Zelda game kind of as it's come out. So I'm really enjoying exploring it as, you know, as you are, as the couple of friends I've mentioned who are also playing it, that the fact that we're all having, as indeed probably every single person around the world playing it, that no one's having exactly the same experience. And I'm enjoying these articles that are coming out about, oh, if, have you found out to do this? Or there's a really amazing video I watched on the GameSpot YouTube channel last week. It was 42 things I bet you didn't know about Tears of the Kingdom. And some of them I'd figured out, but some of them was like, oh, that's amazing, and things like that. So I'm really enjoying this kind of this, I'm in this kind of exploration mode along with everyone else in the world. It's quite exciting because Breath of the Wild, I got it after the fact. I got it at 2019, I think I got that. Maybe 2018. And anyways, it was after it came out anyway. And the other than that, the only other Zelda game I'd bought before that had been Ocarina of Time, which I got on the 3DS when it got re-released on that. I never had an N64 because I never had an N64. Ocarina of Time, I played about half of it and then I gave up because I was quite bored by it. And I think that's because I wasn't... All the stuff it did, new, back when it came out in 98... Because I was playing some 2011, I'd seen it all, copies of it in every single RPG, you know, mostly, in the interim. It was the same reaction I had when I played Super Mario 64 DS, because I bought that for my 3DS as well, and the same thing, I bounced off it. I just wasn't impressed or entertained by it particularly. And then I have played other Zelda games. We talked about Link's Awakening on the podcast, did a whole episode about that. That was borrowed off a friend. Skyward Sword, we've done an episode on that. But again, I bought that as the Switch re-release after the fact. So this is the first time I'm playing a game alongside everyone else. And that's quite exciting. Yeah, in the moment.
Yeah. I don't normally care about that. And I don't normally, I mean, outside of this podcast, I don't normally talk a great deal about my experiences playing games with other people, but there is a notion of this shared experience that I do enjoy.
Well, I'm enjoying recording the podcast each week. We come on and the first
we have a little chat about Zelda.
What have you done this week?
And what's our update?
I'm really enjoying that. It's just how different we are. We're playing the game and what we found out. And I was not spoiling for each other, but I'm enjoying that, the shared exploration, I suppose.
Yeah, Hannah and I are enjoying that too. And we, as you know, I explained that there's this sort of period of adjustment where we're both playing it at the same time but separately. Hannah and I, we've moved past the point where we're trying to protect our own personal exploration, and we're sort of watching each other play, and we're seeing each other do the same things but do them in completely different, with completely different approaches. And that's another thing that I think this game really does well, which you've already touched on, the notion that these shrines are have one way and one way only to engage with them has kind of been exploded. Like, they do still have correct outcomes, but getting to the outcome feels quite a lot more open than maybe it did in Breath of the Wild. A lot of the time you did have to use a specific power in order to do a specific shrine. We're really enjoying that aspect of it as well, like the different paths that we're taking through the game, the different things that we're choosing to engage with. It's very good for that.
Well, let's loop from that then back into kind of you talking about the overworld. We talked about how it feels. So how I've played the game is I've unlocked the last tower. Towers were in Breath of the Wild. And I think in this one, I like the fact they're lit up so you can see them from a lot further away. But I also like the, and this wouldn't fit with Breath of the Wild because it wasn't a mechanic in that, but I like when you activate them, you do the whole thing where you go up into the sky. It feels really epic, and then you can glide down or zoom across or accelerate down to the ground. I really like that whole system as well. So yesterday I unlocked the last tower, so I've now got the whole map unlocked, and I've been going around getting all the towers because that makes traversal a lot easier. You can do warping. I've been getting shrines as I've gone through, and I've upgraded my hearts a few times, my stamina vessel a few times. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to do another sweep, but this time just focusing on shrines. So I'm sort of doing the thing where I'm ignoring the main quest to a certain extent and just focusing on doing all the side stuff. Because, and we'll talk about this again in a bit because there's a lot to talk about here, I think, but there is so much side stuff that it feels a lot busier than Breath of the Wild, which I feel is slightly to its detriment personally, but okay, that's a personal preference. But what I have enjoyed doing that as well is Breath of the Wild, I did the same thing. I unlocked all the towers so I could go get all the shrines, and that was kind of that really with Breath of the Wild. This one's got these things called geoglyphs, which are these enormous chalk outlines that are on the ground, and there's 12 of them, and I've been going to get those as well, because what they do, which I think is really smart, is it unlocks a bit of story done as a memory, and there's no right or wrong order to do these. So you might unlock number one, number two, and then number six, and then number four, and whatever order I did them in, I thought I really enjoyed kind of, oh, okay, I've watched this one. Oh, that explains what happened in that memory there, or I'm watching this one. Oh, this one ties into this one because of how the dialogue or the characters in that. Have you done the geoglyphs before I mentioned what I'm going to talk about next?
I have, yeah. Are you going to, is this a big old? This is one of the big old.
It's a pretty.
Yeah, so spoiler alarm. Go away if you don't want to know anything more about the glyphs.
So I did the 12th one, and then this creature appeared. And I'd joined the dots to think, is this going to happen already? And a 13th memory appeared, and I went and watched that. And what happened with that
It's, again, it's 11 cool. memories
is
plus
it 11?
The 12th. It's 11 plus 1.
Oh, okay.
So the 12th memory appeared, and...
Yeah.
You experience the revelation, which you'd probably already gathered from the previous memories. Yeah.
Interestingly, yeah, I mean, my daughter was with me when we watched this 12th memory. Should I say what it is? Just because you did do a spoiler alert, didn't you?
Yeah, I did a spoiler alarm, a spoiler klaxon, a spoiler awooga.
So Zelda transformed herself into a dragon, one of these enormous Chinese style dragons that you occasionally see flying around the skies with, I presume, is the Master Sword sticking out of the top of her head, and you unlock this 12th memory, and she then appears, and my daughter was with me watching this, and she's really engrossed with this game. And once the cutscene appeared, around where the memory was were all these silent princesses, which these flowers, and I said to her, oh, where have they come from? And she said, well, it does say in the blurb for the Silent Princess that they are Zelda's favourite flower, so they've probably appeared because she's flown over as a dragon. Oh yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, I'm gonna come back. Well, no, we haven't really moved off it. Glyphs are a collection. They're a thing that you're collecting.
Completely.
And this game's pretty major on, like, there's a lot of collections to try and get into. And this is something that I think gets maligned in open world games, that they become these collectathons. What I think Tears of the Kingdom does really, really well, that maybe its predecessor didn't do, is to redefine or reimagine what collecting a thing entails. So you do have some more straightforward ones, like the glyphs, and that's where a lot of the story happens. And there is a facsimile in Breath of the Wild in terms of the memories that you collected.
But they were
the game.
A lot harder to find, though, weren't they? It was a lot more buried.
They were, yeah, for sure. They definitely were. So that is a fairly straightforward, a fairly down the line collection that you're doing, these 12 memories. But you then also have wells. Like, there are 58 or 59, 58, I think.
Yeah,
58,
I think 58
total. Wells. And well sounds really boring, but they go along with another collection, the caves.
Mm-hmm.
So the wells and the caves, those two things, they are actually a thing you're collecting, and you're doing it. There is a bit of an in-game sort of impetus, a drive to do it, because two people have requested certain things from the wells and the caves. And The thing is about that, they're not just regular collections, because what you're collecting there isn't like a little trinket that'll sit in your inventory unused and unloved, like it might be in a Far Cry game or an Assassin's Creed game or any of the other big old sandboxy open worldy games. It's not a bunch of pigeons that you've got to shoot that, you know. These things are actually experiences. You're collecting experiences. You might drop into a well and find that it's just an old abandoned well. You might drop into a well and find that actually it's a cave system that connects you to three other wells in the area. You might drop into a well and find that actually the well is hiding an entrance to the underground, to the depths, and you didn't expect or anticipate falling hundreds and hundreds of feet into this gloomy, dark, scary place when you just jumped into that well. Similarly, caves, they can run the gamut of being small affairs to very, very large affairs. And you are...
with beasts or treasure or items
exactly.
in it. And that's
yeah,
the
or something
lottery.
Intriguing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the fact that these are your collectibles, you do still also, again, have more standard things, the Koroks and the glyphs. But the fact that they've also broadened out what the notion of a collectible might be and made it that you're collecting these experiences and these moments, I really love that. I think it's a fantastic idea, and I hope more games steal it.
And there's the stone tablets as well. Have you done many of them yet?
You mean the ones that are floating on
yeah.
the... Yeah, so they're another collection. And again, I like the fact that it's not just a case of... it's not just a case of go to that place, find that tablet, take a photo. When you interact with these things, lots of different things, well, the same thing can happen quite often, but actually the results of that same thing happening are different in a number of different ways.
Well, it's lore. So you find these stone tablets, there's a character in Kakariko Village who can speak ancient Hyrulean, and you take a photo and you go and show him, and you get a reward for it, but it's a way to piece together what has happened historically over the sort of the timeline that's led to Tears of the Kingdom coming out. The thing that happened is that where you go on the platform and it crumbles in the sky and it crumbles.
Yeah.
I've had that.
I was going to leave that because it was fun.
Oh, okay. It was very fun when it happened to me, but So we mentioned the sky, the fact you can explore the sky, and that was the thing that was mentioned in lots of the blurb when the game came out. We haven't talked about the depths yet, so
these are the two ways that they've broadened out this world. They've gone vertical, and everyone was, you know, ecstatic that they were going up, but no one... Well, there were some murmurings, like, wouldn't it be great if there was an underground version of Hyrule? And it was kind of wanted, but they kept it fairly under wraps. Like, you did see some shots of some underground, some places in the depths in some of the trailers, but it was still a bit up in the air, pun not intended, as to whether they were just very large cave systems or whether there was going to be this great amount of exploration to do underneath Hyrule. Turns out, spoiler klaxon, that it's there, and it's a full-blown map.
It's the entire map.
Places to go, yeah.
So they've taken all of Hyrule, and there's another layer. Imagine a BLT where you've got L is your Hyrule, B is the sky, and then T is the depths. It's the entire like-for-like. No bread in the sandwich. It's entire life for like. It's just massive. Now, the depths as a thing, I find the depths really creepy and sinister.
Yeah.
And I can't put my finger on... Well, I can't know why. I've not played... Like, an absolute horror game or a scary game, like Resident Evil, Dino Crisis, whatever, like, fine. Like, they have jump scares, they have bits that scare me, bits that make me jump, etc. The depths just has this constant feeling of unease when I go into it, and I really don't like it. And I think they've done such an amazing job at making me feel that way. It's even the thing I said to you tonight before we started recording. I've noticed this week that when you go into the depths, you get this, I think it's a bassoon. There's just this long, almost slightly discordant note. Yeah. And it's so unsettling. And so you're in the depths, and you've got, in a similar system to the shrines on Hyrule, you've got to find these things called light roots. And when you find one, and there's 120 of them, and they're like for like with the shrines on the surface, I realise. So wherever there's a position of a shrine on the surface, there is a light root equivalent directly underneath it. Or equally, if you find a light root, you know there's a shrine above it. So it then makes exploring and unlocking the shrines on Hyrule, it makes it a bit easier. I also realised, I was very chuffed with myself when I noticed this, and I googled it. Turns out other people have noticed this as well. Well, there's the shrines, the fact that if you've got a shrine, whatever the letters are, the light route is the same name but backwards.
Mm. And then, okay.
And then it's the topography. So you've got, if on Hyrule you've got a big old mountain, in the depths it's a big old valley. In Hyrule, if it's a river, then the bed of that river in the depths then becomes an elevated road that you could follow. So I really like the way they've linked the two things together. But without these light routes, you've just got darkness.
You've kind of led with the backwards names of the shrines and the light routes there, but actually the thing that you was most impressive when you text me about these different things over the course of a couple of days was this notion of the topography being an inverted version of what's above, and actually this whole thing, the depths, is actually a riff on something that's come up time and time again in lots of different Zelda games, and that is the notion that there is a mirror world or an anti-world, such as
Hyrule and Lowrule. That's another Zelda game I did forget to mention when I went through my list earlier. That is a game that's from A Link Between Worlds, on the 3DS, but again, I played that after the fact.
Which is fab. Yes,
yeah, Lowrule.
There's also, that is a sequel to A Link to the Past that is on the SNES, and there's the Light World and the Dark World, and there's the Twilight World and the and there's Hyrule and the Twilight World in
Twilight Princess, I'm guessing.
In Twilight Princess, in Wind Waker, you have Hyrule and then you have Old Hyrule at the bottom of the ocean.
Oh, okay.
And so it's not quite the same thing there, but this notion of there being a world and a world beneath the world, or a mirror world of one kind or another, or an anti-world, like in the form of a dark version of the same world that you know. The depths is the same thing. It's a riff on that whole on that trope in Zelda games, and the way that they've done it is, I think, absolutely top notch. The way you explore above ground, the way you explore Hyrule, the way that you explored it before in Breath of the Wild, it's all about being very open and being able to see vast distances and being able to pinpoint this thing in on the horizon or in a deep valley because you've managed to get high up. It's about openness, and the depths 100% does not do that. It goes the opposite way.
So light roots, which I mentioned already, they are, once you activate them, in a similar way to the towers that unlock the swathes of the map, the light route unlocks swathes of light. So when there's dark and you can't see, there might be enemies, there might be mountains, there might be big patches of gloom, which is this horrible gloopy stuff that if you go into it will gradually eat away at your hearts, and it not even eats away at them, it takes them off you. So if you go into the gloom with 4 hearts, it will take away one of those hearts down to 3, but you can't, if you ate an apple, to get your hearts back. No, you have to do something else to restore that back. The light route will cast all its light in this area so you can see, oh, there's some horrendous looking enemies over there, I'm going to do my best to avoid them. And it then becomes all about going from light route to light route just to unlock them out bit by bit. But that traversal, as you've just said, the Hyrule is all about openness and light, and you can see. The depths, by its very nature, is claustrophobic and dark, and it's the only way I have found to do it is to use lots and lots of bright bloom seeds, which are small things you find in caves that emit a glow, and you can throw materials in this game, which again is something Breath of the Wild you couldn't do. If you fling down bright bloom seeds, they then emit a small glow, and it's then throwing one, walk up towards it, okay, walk out of its a radius of light, right, throw down another one, do that again. And the whole system, it just makes it feel so, as I said, claustrophobic. It's a very different way to explore the, quote, open world. That, again, it almost inverts what you're doing in Hyrule. It's just, it's such a smart gameplay mechanic again.
It really is. And it distinguishes the depth That's from everything else. Up above, you are gliding these vast distances, and you're everything's open, and you get down into the depths, and you've got, like you said, the claustrophobia. You've got this inching forwards. Mm. You're not taking vast sweeps, or at least at the start, you're not. Maybe you get very brave later on, but you, in general, you're not taking vast sweeps into the darkness. You're trying to sort of plumb your way ever so slowly through the pitch black, and there's good reason to do that as well, because the monsters down there are some of the most terrifying. Mm. I'm not even talking about this one specific monster that I know everybody's up in arms about, and that, again, pun not intended, but the monsters that just inhabit the underworld, the depths, are pretty terrifying in and of themselves. I'm thinking Froxes.
Oh,
like the Froxes. They don't sound, the name Frox makes you sound like, it makes you think of frogs, and they kind of look a bit like lumbering toads in a way, but they are pretty large, they're pretty nimble, and they are very, very difficult to take down. At least my experience of them has been that they're very difficult to take down, and they just emerge out at you out of the darkness. It's pretty terrifying.
The first time I encountered one, it was the battle music kicked in. It had this health bar at the top that said Frocks, and I was like, what on earth? And then suddenly it was over in the distance. I spun the camera around or something. I noticed it, and it oh God, I'm getting the screaming abdabs thinking about it.
Hannah had a running battle with one where it was taking her apart every single time she tried, and she was throwing herself at it time and time again. It was pretty epic to watch, because like she'd get to the point where she was basically on her knees and she'd warp out of there, and then she'd kit up again. It was like watching a failed version of Rambo each time, just throwing herself again and again and again at this Frox each time coming a cropper. It was definitely a lesson watching her, and whenever I've gone into the depths, I've tried to avoid them like the plague. I saw an obsidian Frox. That was the first one that I saw, and I saw it from enough of a distance that I was able to avoid it, and I'm glad that I did. The depths. I thought that the depths were going to be a little bit sort of a, I don't know, like a mouth, lip service sort of thing. Like, oh, well, we'll just throw that in, and it's bulking everything out. And I think you could make the case for it being that, but at the same time, just the feeling of exploring that space, it's so weirdly, it's so different to what we're used to. And there's a compulsion. Like, I feel compelled to try and find those little places, those disparate spaces that actually matter in that vastness. Because there are some places that matter in the depths. I don't know just quite how many, but yeah, just eking out what little distance you can get towards that next objective in the depths is one of my favourite things to do in the game, genuinely.
I've got a couple of quests on the moment that involve me going to the depths to do certain things, and I've put them on the back burner because I just don't want to do it. I will
do. They stress you out.
But it's stressing me out, exactly. Just before we move off the depths then, a couple of other strategies. So what my daughter has found is she found an outfit that has light emitting off it. It's like a miner's outfit or something. And she... this afternoon she went to a great fairy and did a quest involving that, because they pop up in this game again, so it's in Breath of the Wild. I noticed in this one, I don't know if it's the case in Breath of the Wild, but the music is the same as the fairy music in previous Zelda games. So that was cool.
I can't remember, to be honest, but I think possibly it was, yeah.
And so that these, because it's a miner's outfit, it emits a bit of light, which does make things a bit easier, but it's still not, you can't see massively far ahead. And then one of my friends is playing, so I've mentioned already, he suggested he used Ultra Hand. He tooled together this flying machine using a couple of planks of wood and some fans, and then he put a load of lights on the outside of it. So he's bezzing around the depths on this flying carpet, essentially, that's got lights streaming out of it in all directions. So that's just a suggestion.
Again, different strokes, aren't they? Yeah. They're different ways of approaching things. I don't know that I'd want to be flying out into the darkness unsure of where I was going to land myself. So yeah, there's that. There's a couple of things that I want to come back around to, if that's all right. We're coming very swiftly upon an hour.
An hour.
So, apologies for that Well, not apologies for that. I hope everybody's enjoying themselves. We've got a couple of more bits that I'd like to touch on. Side quests. You said that you felt like the side quests were a bit too much or made the game too busy.
I feel that in... You talked about this idea of the sense of time, of progression, of six years having passed. I feel playing it through that I'll go to somewhere like a stable, for example, and there's a handful of NPCs milling about and a couple of them might have quests for me, and I'll move on to another stable, and in the interim I might encounter this person with a quest, or there might be Addison who's holding up the sign that I've got to try and figure out how to hold it up. I feel that there's just a lot.
I love those.
Yeah.
That's another collection as well.
It is another collection, yeah.
I have no idea how many there are.
I feel that there's a lot more going on, and I feel that I prefer Breath of the Wild's you against the world. This feels, you've got the Zonai teams that are going out exploring, trying to figure out what's going on. It feels much more of a lived in world. It feels more believable as a space, but I think I prefer the me versus the world from the first, from Breath of the Wild.
I think that the balance is pretty good myself. Like, I really like that it's an inhabited world and that there's been this explosion of activity across this space that I was alone in before, and that I'll oftentimes come across people going about their business and maybe they'll want some help. I really like that. I also think that there is just a flurry of side quests. I've been picking them up whenever they've been available, and I've not really dug into them too much just yet. But again, I'm kind of into that. Like, I've always been of the view that a game is that I don't necessarily think that all games are made to be 100%ed. And actually, I also think that a lot of the time when a game is made with a view to you doing everything in it, it has to be very well considered in order to make every percentage point worth doing. And all too often, especially with open world or sandbox games, you end up with this thing where you're just grinding through things to get to the end. Breath of the Wild was already trying to book that notion, and it did it with the Koroks. The Koroks, famously, if you collected every single Korok and took them to Hestu, you would be given a golden poo. And I think I'm sure that was Nintendo's way of saying, well done you, in a sarcastic tone, because they're not really invested in you going out and doing all of those things. They've populated these collections, certain ones of them, and the world in such a way they've populated the side quests here, and presumably again the Korok seeds, in such a way that you can dip in and do and have your fill, and that there'll always be something for you to do whatever path you take.
Yep.
I don't have any intention of going around and mopping up every single side quest. And I think, personally, that is probably the better way to play it.
I think in Breath of the Wild, I think there were like 70-something side quests, because I think I finished the game and I had like 68 of them done. And I did start doing the sort of 69th, 70th, and then I thought, what's the point? I've done the main game, and actually there's not... I think the prize for doing those ones I'd missed along the way, there wasn't really much to do them, so I just left them.
That's exactly it. Yep. They haven't in so all of these extra bits that you've got, they don't give you these major rewards. Some of them do, like Hannah, as I said, Hannah's done something today that's given her this pretty nifty sword. But I also saw Hannah, she'd taken out a pair of pirate ships, and someone gave her a carrot as a reward. Like, they're not making the statement, they're not making the argument, the developers here, that these are absolutely vital, because they're giving you a carrot as a reward. They're there for you. They're there for your enjoyment. Mm-hmm. And if you're not enjoying them, you shouldn't be doing them.
Yeah.
Because all you're going to get is the carrot. You need to be... The point of it should be the experience as opposed to the reward. I think that's what they're trying to design around.
I think what I may be sort of getting at is that maybe when I'm playing, I certainly feel this way, that this sort of I'll be doing one thing and I get distracted by something else. And while I'm doing that, I get distracted by something else. And then suddenly 2 hours has gone. I've not actually achieved what I initially set out to do. Now, I do quite like that because it's just so vast and so open. But it's maybe sort of my attention, really. But maybe I might have just liked to do that first thing in the first place. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I think you've always got the choice. And I don't know. I'm talking from my own point of view as well. Like, I know that everybody works differently. So, you know, I think there are some drawbacks to it possibly, but for me, it's not a drawback. It's just, it's a bonus. There was another thing that I wanted to talk about and I can't remember what it was. Oh, Ultra Hand. So, before we wrap up, I'm just going to squeeze in some of the very small, well, some of the numbers, because one of the things that we've always been interested in is team sizes, and the team size here is around 300, which to me is not that big for what they've created. On top of that, the game itself is an 18 gigabyte file size.
Wow.
Which I think before it released, when that came out, someone pointed out that it wasn't even as big as the latest Call of Duty patch.
That's mad.
The patch for Call of Duty is bigger than this whole game. It kind of feels like Nintendo are operating on, in terms of those numbers, they're operating on the standards of 10 or 15 years ago, where a team of 300 for a AAA title might well have been somewhat standard, and maybe getting on for the large size. Whereas now, it's not unusual for those games like Call of Duty to have many multiples of studios with many hundreds of people, if not getting into the thousands. You know, famously, I think, Rockstar's, basically all of the studios in Rockstar are understood to be working on GTA 6 in one fashion or another. It's a lot of people hopefully pulling in the same direction as one another to create these absurdly large experiences. Nintendo are doing that with the resources of 15 years ago, and I think that's pretty absurdly amazing. Like, it really speaks of the ingenuity of the team behind this game.
You've also got their care for what comes out, about the quality of it, because there was a story that came out when the game released that it was ready about a year ago, and they decided just to spend a year polishing it and making sure that there are as few bugs as possible. And for them to have the stones to you know, hold that, let's make sure this is absolutely watertight. Let's make sure that Ultra Hands cannot be used to do this in this particular situation. The fact that they did that, I mean, maybe it does happen more than we think as consumers, I don't know, but I would imagine that for the vast majority of the time, if not all the time, once the games are ready, get it out there.
I think there's certainly this narrative building in the games industry that games are being pushed out, so in the people that are playing them, that games are being pushed out the door way before they're ready, and it's resulting in very, very subpar experiences. You can't say that for Zelda. Like, no. You might not like the game, but they've taken their time, and the attention shows, like the care shows. There is also a story, I don't know how true it is, but it was in a Japanese magazine about at a point in the development cycle, very sort of later on in the development cycle, everybody came off their regular duties. Every single one of the team of 300 came off their regular duties and became a games tester. Everybody played the game for a week, and they played it just as is. They didn't have dev tools or anything. It was a release candidate, basically. And every single one of them, whether they were audio design or level design or artists or whatever they were doing, they stopped. Even Aonuma was doing this the same week. They all played the game, and they played it for as much as they could stand, I believe. It apparently resulted in finding some quite important issues.
Wow.
And apparently as well, and this is interesting, that was planned in. Like, they'd always intended to have this moment where everybody would experience the game together for team building purposes, but also for this sort of sanity check QA process, which, it speaks to the priorities of of this team, and I think generally of Nintendo, priorities that maybe aren't shared across the industry.
Wow, what a great story. Lovely.
The last number.
Oh.
And it's the only number that I have for this particular tidbit, is 10 million. Zelda sold 10... Tears of the Kingdom sold 10 million copies in the first 3 days of it being on sale. And the way that compares to other Zelda games is that basically it's outsold in the first 3 days pretty much every single other Zelda game in total numbers, with minor exceptions such as Link's Awakening, which has sold 12 million over the course of three different releases. The Game Boy, the Game Boy Color, and the Switch. Ocarina of Time, which again, its releases are shared between the 3DS and the
N64.
Nintendo 64. Twilight Princess, which again has had a Wii release and a Wii U release, and actually a GameCube release, which was simultaneous to the Wii release. That sold 10 million total across all three of those platforms. And the obvious one in the room, The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, which released across, on Switch and Wii U, and to date, as up-to-date numbers, are 31.5 million. In 3 days, Tears of the Kingdom has become, you could argue, the second best-selling Zelda game in the history of the of the franchise. So, pretty major.
I did see a headline, I didn't read the article, but it said about how the game has had an impact on the UK economy or something like that, just within...
Yeah.
But, I, you know...
Those often... You do mean in terms of people taking the day off to I play Zelda, maybe ringing in sick?
I don't know. I saw the headline and thought, huh, you know.
They often do... I've seen those headlines associated with the more annual releases in the past, where, like, FIFA Day, when FIFA comes out, there's quite a lot of people ringing sick on that day so that they can play FIFA. I think there's a Madden equivalent in the US.
Legends.
And Call of Duty. I think Call of Duty releases quite often see a bit of a dip in productivity in a number of countries around the world. Tears of the Kingdom, Zelda sort of joining that pantheon is an interesting new addition, and certainly a broadening out of that effect. So that's an interesting one. I hadn't seen that.
Cool. Well, there we go. That's Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. I was crapping on about that for well over an hour. I think it's safe to say we both quite like it, don't we? And that we both
It's so good. I liked Breath of the Wild. I bring it up quite often as a touch point for different things, because it's an easily... It's easy for people to understand and access, and a lot of people have played it. Tears of the Kingdom... Personally, I haven't made this argument to the people listening, but I kind of think that Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom are the same experience, just two different parts, not even two different sides of the same coin. They're the same coin, and playing them both will enhance the experience for you. I love it. I love Breath of the Wild, and I love Tears of the Kingdom, all the more so because of Breath of the Wild. So yeah, love it. That was a short answer to your question.
It was great. There's nothing more I can add to it, because I think it's amazing as well. The end.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for listening. Hopefully you've enjoyed it. If you have, if you can join us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, and maybe tell us about your experiences. What have you found out? Is there something amazing that you found out that we haven't mentioned? Or is there something you've discovered that you want to share? And, you know, just come and let us know, because maybe we haven't found it ourselves, and it might be a nice way to signpost us towards something else in the game that's great.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sticking with us for what is a fairly long episode. We've definitely been, what do you say, harping on for enough time now. Thank you for sticking to this moment. We will see you again next week. Bye.
Bye.